Welcome yet again to what might be the final edition of Ebenezer Reformed Church's online Sunday school class. As you know, we've been looking at the issue of using the letters of the New Testament as examples, and more specifically as examples of godly communication. And due to unforeseen circumstances, here we are probably about to put this whole video series on ice. And with still Titus and Philemon to go in Paul's letters, let alone the rest of the letters of the New Testament. So it may ultimately wind up to be something of an incomplete series. Now, in talking about Titus and in taking Titus as an example of godly communication, it's maybe helpful to make a distinction here, and something that hopefully has been clear throughout the series, but just for the record, there's no pretension, there's no thought that what is being said about godly communication is in any way exhaustive or complete. We've been limiting our attention specifically to what do we learn from Paul as an example of a godly communicator from the way he writes his letters. And so there are many passages where Paul will touch on communication, where he will explain to us how to communicate, and yet for the most part, we've passed over those. And that reflection particularly came to mind looking at Titus, because in a sense, the whole letter is basically about communication. Paul is writing to Titus, he's telling him what to do in the work that he has in Crete. And of course, as a pastor in Crete, a lot of Titus's work is communication. I mean, that's an enormous part of the job. And so there are some other elements. There's things like identifying who would be good for church office and things like that that aren't directly related to communication. But a lot of what Titus is supposed to be doing is communicating. And so Paul calls on Paul calls on Titus. I do know what letter we're talking about. Paul calls on Titus in a variety of ways to give godly communication. And so that comes up in chapter 1, where this is one of the requirements for bishops or for overseers, holding fast the faithful word, chapter 1, verse 9, holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able, by sound doctrine, by teaching properly, both to exhort and convict those who contradict. So one of the things that Titus is supposed to be looking for is people who are able to communicate, who are able to communicate the truth, and who are able to communicate the truth convincingly. Or then again, in the very next verses, chapter 1, verses 10 and 11, for there are many insubordinate, both idle talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision, whose mouths must be stopped. Now, there's an interesting feature of godly communication, as Paul is talking to Titus about it. Part of godly communication is answering, rendering speechless even those who are prattling, those who are bringing up falsehoods. And so then there's another exhortation about godly communication in verse 13, therefore rebuke them sharply that they may be sound in the faith. Another part of godly communication is knowing when to administer a good rebuke and when that rebuke is what is really beneficial for somebody's soundness in the faith. Of course, that's not everything. Chapter 2, verse 1, but as for you, speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine. Now, that's not perhaps an example all by itself, right? It's an exhortation that Paul is giving to Titus about how to communicate. And then he's going to go through a list there about what older men, what older women, what young men should do. He's going to exhort servants or slaves to be subject to their masters. He reminds Timothy again, or Titus, I keep saying Timothy. He reminds Titus again, chapter 2, verse 15, speak these things, exhort and rebuke with all authority, let no one despise you. Or chapter 3, verse 1, remind them to be subject to rulers and authorities, to obey, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility to all men. Or again, verse 8, this is a faithful saying, and these things I want you to affirm constantly. On the other hand, avoid, verse 9, foolish disputes, genealogies, contentions, and strivings about the law, for they are unprofitable and useless. Reject a device of man after the first and second admonition. So, looking at how often Paul tells Titus about communication, is there anything that we learn from our more narrow purpose of looking at Titus as an example of Paul himself showing us what godly communication is like? Well, I don't think there's a whole lot that is distinctive to Titus. Obviously, some of those same points are going to crop up again, like how Paul addresses Titus from a standpoint of affection and appreciation, saying to Titus, a true son in our common faith, how he wishes him well, grace, mercy, and peace from God the Father and the Lord Jesus Christ, our Savior, how he uses communication as a way to strengthen the bonds of relationships, chapter 3, verse 15, all who are with me greet you, greet those who love us in the faith, grace be with you all. There's those elements that we've seen before. But what is distinctive, or maybe what we can at least draw out of Titus with a little bit of distinctiveness, then would be, first of all, this point that examples of communication are not enough all by themselves. You notice that Paul gives Titus a lot of direction about what to communicate, how to communicate, to whom to communicate, what makes for a good communicator. Paul talks about all of that explicitly. He's not content, in other words, to let Titus learn this by observation only. And so the first principle then that we could draw out is that while godly communication is certainly something that can be observed in action, and that is a very legitimate way of learning it, I certainly hope so, or otherwise we've been wasting our time these past several months, observing godly communication is one good way to learn about it, but it's not enough. There also needs to be specific practical direction. Paul does give us an example, but Paul gives us more than an example. Another point that comes out from Titus, but we've already seen this from Timothy, is, of course, the question of adaptability, addressing your audience, learning how to speak to these different conditions, learning, first of all, that not exactly the same exhortation or advice needs to be given to people in every situation of life. That's why Paul has different exhortations, for instance, in Ephesians and Colossians. He can address husbands and wives. He can address parents and children. He can address householders, property owners, as well as their servants. Or even here in Titus, again, he speaks to older men. He speaks to older women. He speaks to younger men. He speaks to servants as well. So there's variety. Not everybody needs the exact same thing. But this does come out in a special way in Titus when he's talking about the Cretans. And you remember, Titus is located in Crete. This is where he's doing his work. And it wasn't necessarily an easy environment. Chapter 1, verse 10. For there are many insubordinate, both idle talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision, whose mouths must be stopped, who subvert whole households, teaching things which they ought not for the sake of dishonest gain. One of them, a prophet of their own, said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. This testimony is true. Therefore, rebuke them sharply that they may be sound in the faith, not giving heed to Jewish fables and commandments of men who turn from the truth. Now, there's several very interesting and engaging things that happen in that little passage. But you notice what Paul does to somebody who is laboring in Crete. He cites a Cretan witness to the real problem of Cretan sins. So there's a couple of things about godly communication that can be learned from that. One, of course, is the prudence of calling witnesses who shouldn't be able to be accused of bias, who, if they have a prejudice, it would run in the opposite direction in order to bring a harsh or an accusing word as he does here. In other words, if he had quoted somebody from a rival city saying that the Cretans are terrible, we wouldn't give it too much weight. Shafter residents will often take a little bit of a slam at Wasco residents, and perhaps the same thing happens in reverse. I don't know. So if we really wanted to launch a serious criticism of Wascovians, we probably shouldn't use testimony from Shafter to do that. It would be much more credible if it were someone from Wasco, one of their own, who would bear negative witness about them. So this is sort of a subset of that godly quality of adaptability. Is now we've got this more specifically in terms of you need to bear a negative record about someone for good reason, in this case to equip Titus for his work among them. How do you do that? Well, you do that with witnesses who are unimpeachable. And so Paul quotes a Cretan poet speaking ill of the Cretans to give Titus a dose of realism and to say, this is the sort of people you need to deal with, and this is how you need to deal with them. Before we move on, though, let me just add this. Although there were particularly characteristic Cretan sins, although those sins are not something that you would want to hear said about you, your family, the place where you lived, and although those things were unfortunately true, you notice what Paul doesn't do. He doesn't say, therefore, write them off. Therefore, give up all hope of planting a church there. Therefore, assume that nothing will ever go right. Therefore, think that there is nothing you can do. He sees that there are problems. He sees that there are characteristic problems, that the Cretan culture tends to come to expression in these particularly sinful ways, in these areas of being liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons. But he does not write them off because of that. And that is a tremendous example. That is something that Paul is showing Titus, as well as implicitly telling Titus, by the mere fact that he left him in Crete to set things in order. The people there may have been liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons, but they were still worth working among. They were still worth communicating to. It was still worthwhile to preach the gospel, to ordain elders and deacons, to do his utmost to set up a functioning church among them. Because the reality of deeply ingrained and culturally accepted sin was not the same thing as saying, therefore we can forget about them. That was not Paul's attitude, and that was not something that he communicated to Titus. So a couple of great principles about godly communication that emerge from Titus. First of all, you have that examples aren't enough. There's also a need for direct instruction. And then, of course, there's also that reality that even very sinful people are worth communicating with. So that's what I have for Titus. And obviously other lessons that could be drawn out are there, but I think we've covered those sufficiently talking about other things. Let's see if we can wrap up Philemon, the shortest of Paul's letters, in the few minutes that we have left. Now, Philemon is a little bit different in that Paul is writing to an individual, although he extends greetings to the church in his house, in order to ask a favor. And it's a pretty big favor. There was a slave named Onesimus. He ran away from his owner and apparently wound up in Rome. In Rome, he found the Apostle Paul. We don't know if he was looking for Paul or if it was just God's providence leading him without his own intention, and apparently was converted then under Paul's ministry, and now is ready to be sent back to the man from whom he ran away, but now with a letter of reintroduction from Paul. And so Paul is asking for Onesimus to be forgiven. He is asking for any accusations, any charges that might be brought against Onesimus, whether it was of theft or of any other misdoing, to be dismissed. If there are debts that Onesimus has contracted, Paul is willing to pay for them himself. And he actually expects Philemon to go above and beyond even the favor that he has asked. And so he says, "Let me have joy from you in the Lord. Refresh my heart in the Lord. Having confidence in your obedience, I write to you, knowing that you will do even more than I say." And what he has said is, forgive Onesimus, receive Onesimus, not just as a slave, but as a beloved brother, especially to me, but how much more to you, both in the flesh and in the Lord. So Philemon is supposed to forgive Onesimus. He's supposed to forgive the hurt, whatever financial damage might have been caused, any feelings of betrayal, things of that nature. He's supposed to forgive them because Paul is vouching for Onesimus. Well, how do you ask for an enormous favor like that? How do you ask for a really big favor? Well, Paul does what he always does. He expresses appreciation. He expresses well wishes. He gives thanks for Onesimus, he gives thanks for Philemon. And then notice what he says. "Therefore, though I might be very bold in Christ to command you what is fitting, yet for love's sake, I rather appeal to you." And now he reminds Philemon who he is. "Such a one as Paul, the aged, now also a prisoner of Jesus Christ. I appeal to you for my son Onesimus, whom I have begotten while in my chains." What is he doing? Well, he's reminding Philemon of the relationship that exists between them. And he's not willing to use authority. And I don't think he says that just to say, do what I ask or I'll order you to do it. I think there's more sincerity on Paul's part than that. He recognizes that he could give the order and Philemon would obey it. But he doesn't want this to be an issue of obedience to a command. He wants instead to persuade Philemon from the heart to do what Paul has in mind and even to go beyond what Paul is comfortable saying flat out. So there's a big thing to think about. In our interactions with other people, authority is there, and authority sometimes has to be used. I mean, you find Paul reminding Timothy and Titus to use their authority and not be ashamed of it. But here, although he could command, he prefers instead to ask. Isn't that really better in a lot of ways? To ask rather than to demand, to persuade rather than to require? Paul seemed to think so, in this instance at least. And you think about how much better it would be for the relationship if Onesimus knows that Philemon received him because Paul persuaded him to do that, versus if he knows that Philemon received him because Paul ordered him to do that. There's only so much healing that can happen by barking commands. A lot of it really needs to be a change of perspective. And that's what Paul offers Philemon. There's a little play on his name. So Onesimus means profitable. And Paul says about Onesimus in verse 11, "He once was unprofitable to you, but now is profitable to you and to me." In other words, he's saying, don't think about what an unprofitable servant he was, how he didn't live up to his name when he ran away from you. Think about what's happened since. Think about how God brought him to me, how I begot him in my chains. In other words, how I led him to Christ while I was a captive, how he's been serving me here. Think about the transformation that's happened in Onesimus. And on that basis, receive him. Receive him as you would receive my own heart. And you notice that he goes on to say, "Without your consent, I wanted to do nothing, that your good deed might not be by compulsion, as it were, but voluntary." That's what we're looking for. Now, when I say that, the danger that I immediately anticipate is that somebody will say, okay, then yes, with my wife, with my kids, with my husband, with anybody who's important to me. I'm not going to order them what to do. I'm going to make them want to do it. That might be very counterproductive. You can't make somebody else want to do it. You can show them what's good about it, and you can trust the Lord to work in them. But if you think that you're going to capture your spouse's or your child's heart by aiming at making sure they agree with you in everything, you run the risk of actually creating a worse tyranny than if you just tell them what it is you want them to do. Because there's no tyranny like the tyranny of forcing people to enthusiastically agree with you. That's not what Paul is doing. He's genuinely giving Philemon a choice. He's not keeping Onesimus with him and taking it out of Philemon's hands, but he's aiming for something better than just obedience to his command. But he's not aiming for it through manipulation, through selfishness, through an attempt to force Philemon into doing that. And so when I say that we should aim for something better than obedience, we need to understand, though, that when we're ruling out obedience as the response, we don't get to then fall back on it afterwards. We don't get to then bully until we get the semblance of enthusiastic agreement that we were hoping for. In other words, the challenge of Philemon to our godly communication isn't, how do I extract something better than just external obedience from the people who are under me? Rather, the challenge should be put in terms of, am I using authority when I could be using persuasion instead, when maybe it would be wiser, better, healthier not to command, but to leave something up to somebody else? So there's the big favor that Paul asks for, and then he very straightforwardly also asks for a smaller favor. Verse 22, but meanwhile, also prepare a guest room for me, for I trust that through your prayers I shall be granted to you. You notice that's not a big thing, and Paul just comes right out and asks it. He expects to be granted hospitality. He's confident in the relationship, and that's the last thing that I will say about godly communication from the example of the Apostle Paul. Is that where he was confident in a relationship, he wasn't embarrassed to ask for help. Well, that is maybe something that we all could stand to learn a little bit. May the Lord bless you, and may the Lord equip each one of us to communicate in a more godly way.